a basic wind band repertory. We sort of got into some of this last night in discussing origin of group. But actually, the repertory is spread out over a very wide territory, and it has been in some ways influenced very much, like the development of other aspects of architecture, performance, certain developments in art, by convenient arranging. And actually, in the modern sense, so much of this keeps coming back to the first such organization of materials, principally by the Italians. The Germans, who indeed come in for their full share of the sense of organization of materials and techniques in any century, at the beginning found that sense of organization from the Italians. And the Italians found it in their particular organization of the city, the municipality. The Italian concept of this was, of course, a ducal concept, and the families of long-reigning landed nobility considered it part of their responsibility to maintain what we now call centers of art, what we now describe as cultural areas. And indeed, I suppose they certainly were that for the Duke of Mantua, for instance, or for the Church of Rome, for any of the great cities of the Renaissance country. For in these places were gathered together libraries. And these libraries still contain some of the earliest known examples of ensemble music, regardless of for what medium. But once again, it is a certain sense of responsibility that is the part and parcel of what life was like in such a community, based not upon alone a sense of responsibility to what was happening, not alone a sense of feeling that this was a good thing to sponsor. A certain amount of conscience, I suppose, ran heavily through it. The vast fortunes that filtered in and out of Venice, for instance, or let us take another city in Italy very much in this field, that's Florence. The great buildings there, the great churches, the great public buildings, the museums now, the libraries, the houses, the places of business, which were decorated by the great artists of the time, designed by the great architects of the time, were all a result of not alone a personal conscience, a private conscience, on the part of the wealthy Italian businessman, nobleman, landed gentry, but because it seemed that this was a rather good thing to do. And on this basis, there began a certain gathering together of materials. And this happened in almost every country of the world in which there was transpiring the sort of activity that led to the formation of the orchestra roughly at the beginning of the 17th century. And in England, to take just one example again, you played yesterday a contemporary work by a man who lives and writes and teaches in Texas, based upon what he calls a Tudor psalm. And this was indeed a Tudor psalm, which was of great attraction to another composer, the Englishman Ralph Vaughan Williams, who made of it the famous Fantasia for Double String Orchestra on the theme of Thomas Tallis, which is what Tudor psalm is. And you have here a repository in England that was established by a certain man whose name was Fitzwilliam, and he collected together the pieces that were in his family that people played there, some of which were written there, and gathered them together into a museum. And they now known as they are by as the Fitzwilliam Virginal Book, just to name one, from which came the Gordon Jacob William Byrd Suite and several other pieces that have now since emerged. That similar kind of collection was what preserved things through the years, including some of the music of the town pipers and drummers of places like Leipzig and ancient cities, which observed the changing of the hours of the day by various brass groups that played from towers. The changing of the hour, the changing of the watch was signaled through the streets by the drum, and later by the drum and the fife. And all of this begins to be the beginning of basic wind band repertory. Everything of this time that has been preserved and has some significance for us is a part of that. And since this was the first gathering together of such concentrated materials, you find that everybody these days is turning back into this kind of antiquity to seek out roots. And this is not only right and good, but was an obvious result of a 20th century phenomenon. It's curious how these things interact one upon the other. It's remarkable to behold the incredible interest today in music of the Baroque period. It's fantastic to walk into a house. Well, of course, it's a specialized apartment where you can see a large shelf of wind music out at Bob Reynolds' house, a large shelf of recorded wind material. It's wonderful to note the in-depth dimensions of the recordings of the complete works of whomever. And I think you have to lay this up to the long play record. It is in our century what that remarkable thing, the printing press and the book, had been in a time before. That remarkable breakout, this Renaissance concept of knowledge, this thirst for information, this thirst for the transfer of information from one man to the next. No matter how remote, no matter how frontier life in Kentucky, Mr. Lincoln still had a need for books and found what he needed. And in the deep antiquity of the beginning of the printing press and movable type and making several copies of the same thing, that was such a great breakout. Eventually for music, of course. And now in the 20th century, the existence of the LP record and the need for record companies, record artists, to peel back and find one more title that hasn't been recorded so that they can be the first person to have recorded the whatever, is a marvelous interplay on science, technocracy, the 20th century, and the thirst for knowledge, the need for information. Of course, for the orchestra, this has been a great hunting ground. A great many great reputations and a great deal of individual good fortune has accrued from this business of the long play record. And it is in our century what the breakout of large and responsible printing houses was in the middle of the 19th. And so our literature, which might have existed in a library someplace, in some detached form, manuscript or whatever, all begins to pyramid up into one certain area, the library. And in the library, we find collected those things which were of almost no interest to anybody, except a few precious scholars some years ago. And in the complete works of Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, Berlioz, Haydn, Wagner, Handel, whoever, there are some pieces locked up there that have long now since come out, but which were of no interest to anybody, really, in a performing sense, but because of the absolute, almost religious faith of the printed word or the printed bar, all this has been preserved. Basic wind band repertory has to date from a period in time when there was a basic wind band. Its history locked up somewhere in the beginning of the 19th century. The argument as to which man put the valve together first or applied it first is really not nearly as important as the fact of what resulted from this defeating of nature in one way or the harnessing of it in another. You can look at it whichever way you wish. There are still many people I meet who are very sad that the trumpet ever had valves applied to it. But whether that is a condition with which we wish to wrestle or not, there did exist this period in time during which all this apparatus was going through its own transformation, including the orchestra, that brings us to a point in time where things began to be sort of solidified. And the 19th century is that time. And the composer constantly forcing registers up and down, requiring the technical fulfillment within, going from one substitute method to another substitute method, from hand stopping to hand to crooks to different instruments in all kinds of different pitches, finally solidifying itself in the basic framework of instruments as we know them today. From this point forward, a basic literature is possible to discuss. Backward from that into antiquity, the lines reach back to the individual pieces, like the great mass of Orazio Benevoli, which is a huge, huge score, written for the dedication of the cathedral in Salzburg, again, the beginning of the 17th century. A work designed to harness all forces at their present state of operation, and anybody who wants to see what was the state of music at that time, that's a score for you to look at, although Mr. Benevoli is not a person that anybody much chases down these days. His niche in history is still there from the fact that he did write that piece, and it is there and you may know exactly for what it was scored, and you may see it from the beginning to the end. These pieces that reach back also include masterworks like the Royal Fireworks music of Handel, which has to be a basic wind band piece. Because of the wind band of its time, it was most likely the piece. And today it's available in several arranged versions. Most of it, the edition available through the Oxford University Press, which has been arranged by Anthony Baines and Charles Zimakaris, is a marvelous opportunity to play a great piece out of the past. The remarkable military marches, written by any number of people, now recently exposed in the recording of the Netherlands Wind Ensemble, again reveals what little pieces by great masters can sound like. And they are again a part of our basic repertory. This leads us past that time up to the need for something beyond an outdoor formation of music in moving formation, to the point where some of the works that you find that were in Vienna now being very much uncovered and exposed, published, and available through the remarkable interest and depth and scholarship of David Whitwell, is a whole period of time in there where lots of things were written that he has found that are all available to you, and again, must be a basic part of this whole repertoire. Going from there, we come to some sporadic pieces by Mendelssohn, and his overture is, of course, available in an arrangement, and it is available in the original form through the Mendelssohn Complete Works. All you have to do is copy out the part. Or you can take the published version in the Schirmer edition and modify it by removing the instruments which do not conform to the full original score, which you can indeed see in the complete work. This is a work of by a man of distinguished merit and ability, without question, whose piece was written for a definite function, a visit to a place he enjoyed being. His memory of it was to write such a piece. All these things are occasional pieces in so many ways. Mozart's remarkable serenades were occasional pieces, although the conflicting history about Serenade 10, as to whether or not he did or didn't hear it, and whether or not it was intended to be an audition piece, I still think it most likely was intended as an audition piece. This, of course, is a remarkable, remarkable work, which is the cornerstone of the really modern wind band repertory, to me, because of its substance, its content, and the fact that today it is a more desirable piece in every quarter than it ever was. These pieces, which lead in some direction through to Wagner's Strauss Symphony on the themes of Weber's Euryanthe, is again a work which was a function for a function at its time. Nobody really knows how many times it was played since that evening of the return of Weber's remains to Dresden. Another long period of nothing much happening, except if you want to consider the really very fascinating wind band repertoire that was being written in the United States by various men writing for the bands of the Confederacy and the Union. And I do consider very much the music written for the wind band of the 3rd New Hampshire Regiment that I was very happy to be able to get. I didn't find it, needless to say. As long it had been in existence, it was just a question of finding on what shelf of the Library of Congress it was. And I didn't even do that. That was done by the Lichtenwanger. But there exists in this collection of music that I found called the Port Royal Books, a complete picture of what the brass band was like in the United States in 1860. These books in the Library of Congress are simply called the Port Royal Band Books, and that is what I used to record the music of the Civil War. There were some 49 titles in this band book, all of which was written by a remarkable composer whose name was Claudio Grafula. You know him as the writer of the Washington Grays March. Well, he was kind of the Robert Russell Bennett of his day. He arranged music for any side, north or south, as long as they paid his price. And he was indeed a remarkable writer, a remarkable arranger. When I say arranger, you bought a book from him, that was everything for balls, burials, parades, concerts, dances, entertainment, diversion, all great military ceremonies. This book had everything, including potpourris on operatic themes, some of which are the best I know. The one I think on Freischütz is out of sight. And a series of waltzes, all kinds of quick steps based upon Verdi operas. This was the music of our time in this country in the 1860s, and Grafula's book is a marvelous example of it. And since that time, some of my equally nutty friends have been ratting around in museums, and they have come up with five more such sets of books for the same band in a museum in New Hampshire.
Could you give us just a real quick rundown, Dr. Pinella, on like what the instrumentation was of that?
Well, that was a brass band to begin with. The over-the-shoulder horn band, the essentially conical bore instruments perfected by Adolf Sachs and manufactured and promoted by him, also manufactured and promoted in this country by a family, a very enterprising family by the name of Dodsworth, that even made the instruction book to go with it and would go any place and teach a brass band to play. And it made up a family of two E-flat soprano cornets, two B-flat soprano cornets, two E-flat altos, two baritones, and two bass. The baritones in B-flat, the bass is in E-flat. And they made the instruments and they sold the instruments. That was a complete package. And they were quite remarkable, and if you want to hear what they sound like, you can hear them on the record, which I made, a two-volume set of music of the Civil War. We did it on those instruments, too. But that's another story. But this was music at that time for bands in this country. Being enterprising, the leader of this band was not satisfied with just brass. He eventually started writing out parts for clarinets and flutes. And there does exist a set of books that we used, which had parts for clarinets, parts for flutes, and parts for all the brass instruments, a snare drum and a bass drum. And this was what we were doing in wind band repertory in this country, and it wasn't really terribly much different from what was being done in Europe, aside from the ceremonial music coming some years later, written by Wagner. Ceremonial music before that, written by Wagner, and the operatic music written and played for the first time in toto in Wagner's great Festspielhaus just about 11 years after the end of the Civil War. So all this was starting to come to a certain head because a machinery existed. And the music of the French Revolution, not to pass it by, or to say it is not important, because it was really terribly important, not so much for what it was as music, but for what, or for what it even is today as music. And you know that you can indeed acquire some contemporary versions of the military, for instance, the Military Symphony by Gossec and others, There is some music from this time, but it was essentially a kind of functional music that was written for these first great Woodstocks of Paris. This was the first time that the people really had it. And they took out to the parks that had been only for the nobility in such great droves, and they had these great balls, and the music that went with it was written by the bandmasters at the time. And they, of course, became the founders of the Paris Conservatory, and their niche in history is somewhat secure and rather different from that of the bandmasters and performers that they started out to be. But this music that they wrote was highly functional, and it is a part of history. How much it is a part of the wind band repertoire today is, I think, entirely up to your individual desires to play it. Hand in glove with this, the incredible revolutionary Hector Berlioz, who was at home in all fields and fielded his music wherever he could find it, left us the first work of its kind, of any substance and length, by the term symphony in this way, whose grand symphony, funereal and triumphal, that he wrote for a great public occasion, and which requires a large orchestra and a large band and a large chorus for its proper performance, is the first work of its kind. Remarkable, this second movement with this incredible trombone solo. It's amazing this piece doesn't get played more than it does. I'm sorry I never got a chance to record it in Rochester, because we had it all figured out to be done, but sometimes plans change. And that was the next thing to be done in the recorded series that we had mapped out. But this is, of course, a monumental work, and it is available in the Mercury Now Presser edition in a version for contemporary bands, adapted, I think, by both Leiden together with Goldman. And for the last movement, you have to rent the string parts. You can buy the chorus parts, but that's not such a big deal to rent those string parts, and might be a good opportunity to wed once again together all the forces in your school for a significant piece of music, which is a ball to play and real Berlioz all the way. After that, we're pretty fallow for a while. The world was so completely gassed by Richard Wagner. And it's very hard to imagine what it must have been like. But he must have been such a towering octopus. He must have covered so many fields of endeavor. And he must have absorbed so much ink and so much thought and so much conversation and so much wine and so much beer. Must have been quaffed either at him or over him. And in his wake, there were bound to come others. And they did. But none of them took up the cudgel of the band. This had to be something really for the British to do. The works of the French leading up to this, a couple of them, of course, are very remarkable, but they antedate the British works. It's again a crying shame, the absence of fresh material in the 20th century from the Italians. But it's a fact, it isn't there. Transcriptions, and magnificent transcriptions, are there. Indeed they are there. For the Italian band. The Noah's Ark band. They have two of everything. That's why it never caught on in our country. Because we don't go for two of everything. If you can't play jazz with it, forget it. The instruments we have are jazz instruments. Instruments which are sympathetic in the field of jazz. Those are the ones that survive. flugelhorn has come into it in the last 20 years, let's say. But there were flugelhorns in American school bands in the late 20s, only because the British had them in their band, and the American Bandmasters Association thought it would be a good idea to revise an instrumentation, the first of several billion committees on the subject, which have been appointed to achieve nothing. But every alphabetically lettered group has one. And the Italian instrumentation is a remarkable instrumentation for the Italian. I don't think there's anybody in this room who could have heard, I know there isn't anybody in this room who could have heard there might be one or two, who could have heard the National Fascist Band of Italy tour this country in 1933. It was one of the most remarkable groups I ever heard anywhere. I stumbled into a concert that they played at the World's Fair in Chicago. The National Music Camp had its last week in Chicago that year. And we played concerts with the orchestra, concerts with the band, with Dr. Harding and with Dr. Bakalennikoff, Joseph Matty, in the Hall of States on what is now McCormick Place. I made my debut as a conductor at that set of concerts, conducting a piece of my own, which was subsequently published, so I thought I would quit while I was ahead, and became a conductor instead of a composer. But I heard this band play at the Hall of Nations, and I wasn't so sure I wanted to hear it play, because that was what the name of the group was, the National Fascist Band of Italy. And being very young and extremely impressionable and knowing what fascism already was, I wasn't sure I wanted to go hear it. And I almost didn't, entirely on that basis. But there was this very interesting and very marvelous young lady with whom I was very much in love that said that I would be making a mistake if I didn't go. So I went. And I've never heard any band in the world like that one. Never. No band anywhere. And I've listened for them all since. It's not alone what they played and how they played, but it was just a whole thing. Absolutely remarkable. I had to get back to quarters, which was for us in the dormitories at the University of Chicago, and we had to be in quarters just like we were at camp. There was a certain time we had to check in. So I couldn't hang around and ask any questions, except I did snitch a program. And strangely enough, the first night I arrived in Rochester, New York to go to school, first thing I saw pasted up on a signboard was National Fascist Band of Italy, tonight, Convention Hall. Well, I promptly went and got everybody I could get to come and go to the concert. And it was again, the second time I'd ever heard of a group quite like that. That night had a chance to find out what about the group. And if it would interest you, I would like to tell you. It came from one little town on a hillside in Italy. All the players in this band came from one town. It was the town of Chieti. And this one man had taught every one of these people to play, like his father before him had taught every one of them to play. And the E-flat E-flat sopranino cornet player looked like he had been born with a mouthpiece to his chops. And he soared up in the tessitura regions of this instrument with the ease of a piccolo. And he was the solo player of that instrument, but there were several like him. And Mussolini heard this band play once, and he said, that's it. So he just moved the whole band to Rome and then sent it all around the world to play wherever it was important to represent the Italy of Mussolini in the very best light. They all stood during the concert. Nobody sat. The tubas had pedestals on which rested the tubas. Every one of the instruments belonged to this group, and you sort of signed on with one when you were born. If you were born male in that town, somebody already decided what you were going to play, figuring the attrition rate of those ahead. They played a performance of the New World Symphony, of the unfinished symphony, that was absolutely unforgettable. And I don't usually think this is a great work that way, although it transcribes well. But the performance of it, the playing of it, was sheer velvet, utter magnificence. There was, for this massive clarinet section, some 40 players. There was no technical problem. It was, every player was as good as the first player. From the A-flat sopranino down to the E-flat, 5 E-flats, 4 A-flats. Only 2 bass clarinets, but a family of sousaphones, horns, and a full family of flicorno. And the tubas were considered to be of the flicorno family, not the tuba family. A very remarkable experience. They made some records, and if you dig around and are willing to pay enough money, you can still find a recording of Perpetual Motion of Paganini played by that clarinet section. I have lost 4 of them, and I'm never going to get one back, I'm sure. But I've had that many, and they're all gone. But it was on Decca record, 10-inch. On the other side was a famous Italian symphonic march, not in Ingolosino. And everything that they played was absolutely sensational. They went back to Italy and really haven't been heard from since. And the Metropolitan of Rome, which is a wonderful band, which I've heard twice since then. I mean, they can't unpack the instruments for those guys. It was really quite something. But they played an entirely transcribed Italian band literature, published by Ricordi. And you all know, you've all seen these scores. They are there if you want to adjust. And I did make adjustments in Rochester to play them. I played every one of those transcriptions because I felt I had to. It took some doing, including all of the symphony by Alberto Franchetti, the one in E minor that Dr. Harding used to like to play. And he now has a nephew who teaches on the faculty of Julius Hart College in Hartford, Connecticut, that writes some of the greatest contemporary wind ensemble music anybody is writing. Same name, Franchetti. But this period of the coming on of the Italian band for the Italian area, and it's really fun to go to Venice and sit out in the square and listen to all of Rigoletto from the beginning to the end. That's a ball. But again, how basic that is to our repertory as a whole opera, I wouldn't know. We have to come next in our own country to the breakout period after the Civil War. And the person responsible for all the breakout was a rather remarkable man who really does not have his proper place in American history, let alone American music history, let alone American wind band history. His name was Patrick Sarsfield Gilmore. And someday, I hope I live long enough to write a book about him. But I don't think I'm going to get to that. I know two other guys that can do the job much better. Gilmore was a man at the right moment, in the right place, at the right time, with all that it took to make it go. He was bandmaster for the 12th Massachusetts Regiment, which was a fun and games regiment in the late 1850s, made up of Boston dandies whose family thought it would be nice to belong to a regiment, and who suddenly found themselves in the middle of a shooting war. And Gilmore rapidly saw what he could do, and he had about four bands going at once, even at that time in Boston. And it was his band that created a big mob scene in New York by taking the Massachusetts Regiment down Broadway at the height of the big razzle-dazzle. We got to get those men and get going on this thing. And that was the birth of a thing called the Hallelujah Regiment, because they all kept playing John Brown's Body, which was rapidly catching on as a pop tune. And Gilmore could see here was something fantastic that had never been touched in this country. He fortunately lived long enough to get appointed inspector of army bands in, of all places, New Orleans during the war. And he organized his first Monster Peace Jubilee there. And it took place in that fantastic square. And he brought in all the bands he could find from anywhere and put them together in that square. And they obviously played something that impressed everybody, because they sent Mr. Gilmore from there back to Washington to see what he could do about the rest of the bands in the army. And so he was right on the scene when the thing ended and just went back home to Boston and moved in to a whole situation in which he created for us in our country the great appetite for the band. He started by, first of all, arranging the first visit to this country of the Strauss, small chore which he threw over his shoulder, organizing an orchestra of, 10,000 players, a choir of 20,000 people. I don't know if those are the right figures, but they're appropriately monstrous. Having these things all come off, big deals. He also brought to our country the first foreign bands for a contest. For the first time came the Grenadiers. For the first time came the Garde Républicaine. For the first time came bands from Germany. And then he set out across the country traveling. The railroad train was just really making it. And he took it every place. And at this particular point, Sousa is out on tour someplace with a rinky-dink operetta, and the Marine band says, "You better come back. This is too good a business to pass up." So Sousa went back to Washington to go to the leadership of the Marine band after he'd been in it and out as a player. And he was just starting the tour and doing well with the Marine band when at the St. Louis Exposition in 92, Gilmore dropped dead. And Sousa just moved in and took over everything that Gilmore had set up and went. And Sousa played a literature that entertained. He never claimed to be an educator, a reformer, and anything other than an entertainer. He was the first man in history to make $1 million playing one-night stands, doing just exactly that. His repertory is available to be observed by you all in Paul Brierley's marvelous new books, both of them. He has two books, one on the music of Sousa and another on the life of Sousa.